This is episode 63 of the Renew the Arts podcast. Mailbag. 1,000 true fans earned gifts, magic, and Christmas. Welcome to the Renew the Arts podcast, where we discuss the role of art and creativity in the church and in the world. I'm your host, Michael Minkoff. Our motto at Renew the Arts is liberate Christian creativity, and we're doing this through cultivating Christian communities in and through the arts by inspiring art patronage and supporting artists. If you'd like to join our community of monthly donors and contribute to this podcast, please visit renewthearts.org/donate. If you want to join the Porchlight Network and begin your journey into patronage, go to app.porchlight.art and sign up as a host or a tender. Today, I am by myself yet again, but I have a few questions from you for our mailbag episode, our season-ending mailbag episode, which I have titled, a little tongue-in-cheek, 1,000 True Fans, Earned Gifts, Magic, and Christmas, which you can kind of take however you want. If you're a true fan, maybe you too can earn gifts, magic, and Christmas. We will see. So I'm just going to get right into it. All right. So our first question is on the problem of fame, and it is this. Social media like Instagram and streaming services like Spotify have effectively been geared and rewired to focus on fame and virality. They are terrible for reaching your existing fans and followers, but great for the possibility of fame, for the chance of reaching untold thousands or millions of strangers. For artists who are actively avoiding fame, do you think it's wise to stay off of these social and streaming platforms entirely? Do you foresee a future where artists can find smaller versions of success while remaining offline, in a sense? And what do you think of the 1,000 true fans principle? So there's a few different things going on in this question. For one, I don't know of many artists who are actively avoiding fame. I think fame is probably actively avoiding them, but I do understand this. And I've also seen with a lot of the Spotify Wrapped, it's pretty much every single year that some artist is making some sort of a post about either how Spotify Wrapped of other artists make them feel bad, or their own Wrapped stats make them feel bad, or whatever. Everybody's always feeling bad, or they're, you know, being courageous to show you that I'm just going to show you my numbers, even though they don't look very good, because that's how authentic I mean. I don't care. I'm not trying to judge anybody's motives, but honestly, that whole Spotify Wrapped rigmarole, I could just do entirely without it. Just post your numbers and, you know, if you're not huge, maybe you're big in Japan or something, you know, you're doing what you do and you're doing what you can. If you don't want to talk about the numbers, then it's actually a really easy way to avoid that. But that's a little bit of a sidetrack. Let's get back to this. Let's talk first about the 1,000 True Fans principle. It's an idea that author and Wired founding editor Kevin Kelly originated that the idea is basically you don't need millions of fans or conventional stardom to make a living as an artist or creator. You just need 1,000 true fans. And just as an aside, I knew about Kevin Kelly from his book Out of Control, which I read a number of years ago. And it explores some real-world applications of cybernetics and theories of control. And it's a really good book. Totally unrelated, complete aside. But when I was looking into the 1,000 True Fans, I was like, oh, Kevin Kelly, I know that guy. I don't know him personally. I wish I did. He seems like a really super cool, interesting guy. But you should definitely check that book out if you're interested in, you know, good food for thought and that's something interesting to you. All right, let's back to the question, 1,000 True Fans. Okay, so Kevin Kelly clarified his 1,000 True Fans theory in a more recent edit of his original 2008 essay. And he said that true fans are defined as fans that will basically buy everything you produce sight unseen and are directly engaged with you. So the idea of a true fan is it doesn't really matter what you produce. Like even if they didn't listen to it beforehand or see it on streaming services or whatnot, they're going to pay the money and they're going to buy it. And they're going to directly engage with you about it, probably. Further, this principle, according to Kelly, assumes that you, the creator, are creating at least $100 of material that could be bought a year. So that would amount, like if you're making $100 of material that could be bought and you have 1,000 true fans that are buying that material sight unseen, that would amount to about $100,000 a year by the way. So if 1,000 true fans bought $100 a year, you'd make $100,000 a year. And you might lose a little in fees and stuff, but still, I don't think most artists actually even need that much. But the idea is that instead of general and largely anonymous fame with unengaged, casual, and usually fickle consumers who may not even know about your next album or not like it or not support it or whatnot, you just need to develop a much smaller and probably much more feasible number of actually engaged true fans. He says 1,000. It'd probably be less than that, actually, for a lot of people. And I tend to agree with the idea. I think it's a really good idea. It's one of the ideas behind the Porchlight Arts and Hospitality Network. I think also that Kelly's conclusion from the essay is worth quoting. He says, the takeaway, 1,000 true fans is an alternative path to success other than stardom. Instead of trying to reach the narrow and unlikely peaks of platinum bestseller hits, blockbusters, and celebrity status, you can aim for direct connection with 1,000 true fans. On your way, no matter how many fans you actually succeed in gaining, you'll be surrounded not by faddish infatuation, but by genuine and true appreciation. It's a much saner destiny to hope for, and you are much more likely to actually arrive there. I think that's a good word, and I think it's worth taking it. The whole essay actually is worth reading. I'll link to it in our show notes. So you'll need some kind of eventual platform, though, to draw in and engage with fans from the larger number of casual impressions that you might get on social media or streaming services. And that may not replace social media or streaming services entirely. Like services like Spotify or Netflix will probably remain helpful clearinghouses of your work so that even hardcore fans have a convenient way to access whatever you're producing from wherever they are. But these platforms obviously do not guarantee that you will develop true fans, and they're not even baseline sufficient for even beginning to engage with most true fans. You just can't even engage with most true fans on these platforms. There's not even a way to on the streaming services. And I agree with the original post that Instagram is not really great. And oftentimes your fans and your followers, which is very frustrating, don't even see your posts. They have to double subscribe or something. I don't know. The algorithm is definitely oriented towards getting you to pay for advertising, even to advertise to your own fans and followers. So that's a little frustrating, especially if you don't have a huge amount of expendable income because you're actually trying to make an income from being a creator and you're not yet there. So that's a bottleneck. It's a problem. It's a vicious cycle. It's a catch-22. I understand. I've heard it 1,000 times. And so maybe in order to engage and develop true fans, you really need a different kind of platform. I've found Patreon, Substack, Discord servers, crowdfunding like Kickstarter, and GoFundMe, things like that seem like better platforms for direct fan engagement, even if you're staying online, which I don't think you can really escape that at this point. The idea that we might eventually be able to be totally offline, maybe if you live in a much more Luddite, almost Amish type community. But as things are right now, I don't think that's entirely possible. But I do think face-to-face networks like Porchlight seem even more important for the development of lifelong true fans. And I think those will continue to grow in importance and probably overtake some of these other methods people are trying to use to get connections that really aren't working very well for them. Most artists, though, I don't think will probably ever be able to support themselves being totally offline. I mean, let's just face it, even the Porchlight Network still uses online tools to facilitate connection and stuff like that. So certainly, if I were giving advice to artists who want to avoid the pitfalls and frustrations of the search for fame, which, full disclosure, I don't even think you should be searching for, but I would recommend developing a strategy to serve the fans you already have more directly and more personally, and then try to develop more of the kind of fan you actually want to have person to person. It's really not glamorous, and like Kelly said, though, it's real, and it's much more attainable. Okay, so it's a complicated issue, I understand, and I've tried to provide some strategies to address this in the Problem of Fame episodes, but I feel like I've barely scratched the surface. So a lot more thought, a lot more effort, a lot more of a practical mind than mine will probably have to start trying to figure out stuff like this, but you know, go to it and let's try and make this work. And thank you for your question. All right, so next question. This is from the narcissism episode, and it is it possible that an artist would not consider their gift to be received because they put in a lot of hard work honing it, so it feels like something they brought to themselves, like taking lessons or going to school, practicing, doing low-paying jobs for exposure, etc.? So I guess the idea there is, I talked about in the narcissism episode how a lot of narcissists feel that they have been given these great gifts, and if only they could realize, hey, they've been given something, and it's not something that they earned or that they made for themselves or that they could produce, etc., then maybe they would have the humility to recognize that it's also not theirs to use and shouldn't be identified with themselves, and etc. Maybe that would be helpful. So what this question is asking is, there are people out there who, rather than having great talent or some kind of extraordinary gift without any effort, actually have put a lot of effort into taking lessons or going to school or whatever and developing these skills to become great. And in that case, do they have a little bit, is it a little more reasonable to believe that they might consider themselves extremely important or more important than others or whatever, that they'd have pride or whatnot? And it's a good question. I think there's a difference, though, here between narcissism and pride. And maybe not all pride is even wrong, depending on what you mean by the word. Like if you, quote, take pride, i.e. feel satisfied and accomplished in some work you've done, I don't think that's wrong. I know there are people who don't even want to use the word, and that's fine and everything. But we know what people mean when they say, I'm really proud of this work. And they don't mean that they have sinful feelings of superiority necessarily. So anyway, we can calm down a little bit on that one. But most people who develop real skill tend to understand their place in the larger community. And that's very important. You learn from masters by imitating them, from your mentors and your teachers by imitating them. And it's hard, really, at that point, no matter how skilled you are, to set yourself apart as if your quote-unquote talent is unique. If you don't have some gift or talent beyond what you've learned in the footsteps of others or on the shoulders of giants. So I would make a distinction here between narcissism, which is the idea that you are special and unlike anyone else, and pride in some accomplishment or skill, which almost certainly came from self-conscious imitation and membership in a community. And you're well aware of that, meaning you're not thinking, I'm so different than this community. You have been trying to organize yourself in that community and figure out how to do all the things that everybody else is able to do and learn from other people and learn at the hands of people who you know are superior to you in those skills. And even if you prove in the end to be superior in those skills to your teacher eventually, the reality is you didn't learn those skills out of nowhere. They didn't just come to you. You learned them because there's already an established study and discipline that has organized and developed those skills. And unless you have extraordinary talent, you're probably not adding anything to those skills. So that's important, meaning that if you are a skilled artisan, you're probably not going to suffer from narcissism just on the basis of the fact that in order to become skilled, you will have had to submit yourself to the conventions of a particular community and recognized in that whole entire process that you're not terribly different from or special or unique, and that there's not a whole lot new under the sun, and that sometimes it's not worth reinventing the wheel, and et cetera, et cetera. So you might still be unduly proud, meaning you might still think you're better than everybody else, and if you do, then you should address that. But that kind of pride is not usually what we would call narcissism. Narcissism comes from considering yourself in possession of something unique, which sets you apart from and makes you superior to all others. And it also frees you from any burden to follow the rules or paths of others. So a skilled artist or artisan will be less likely to fall into that trap. And a narcissist, let's just be honest, is less likely to be skilled. He might be really gifted, but he's actually less likely to be skilled because he thinks himself above training and imitation, and he's probably not going to submit himself to these lowbrow people who don't know what they're doing. In fact, maybe a good cure for narcissism, or at least the delusions of grandeur that usually are a part of it, might very well just be training. If you think you have something great and you don't, nothing better than training to prove that to you. And even if you are good, if you are great, if you are greatly talented, you will probably find yourself much humbled by this. I think about the story of George Gershwin, who from a young age was recognized as a musical genius, but he was always asking great composers when he met them if they would give him lessons. Apparently he asked Ravel for lessons. And Ravel said, no, I'd just make you a second-rate Ravel. Better that you be a first-rate Gershwin. And apparently he asked Stravinsky for lessons. Stravinsky asked him how much Gershwin was making a year. He says, I don't know, $200,000 a year. And Stravinsky was like, well, perhaps I should be taking lessons from you. Anyway, those are probably apocryphal, and who knows if they even happen. But the point being, Gershwin was not too proud to ask skilled, trained musicians to train him in harmony and in classical composition and in musical theory, because he didn't think that that was going to ruin him, or that he was above that. And that kind of humility is part of what made Gershwin not just a good, gifted guy who could kind of get by and never have to really try, but actually one of the greats. Most of the greats have combined gifts with skill. And anyway, so learning those skills and learning to be trained and submit yourself to masters and the imitation of masters, part of how you're actually going to deal with delusions of grandeur, it'll kind of remove them. If you don't have what it takes, you're just not going to cut it. And if you don't have delusions of grandeur and you're actually great, it'll make you even greater, and it'll still probably humble you and teach you to appreciate the community and the whole world that you're coming into, the system that's already been made, the things that have already been done by other people that you're a part of. So maybe that would be helpful. Anyway, following up too on my mech armor analogy from the Narcissism podcast, the skills you gain in using a gift really mean nothing apart from the gift. So even skills are dependent for their usefulness on the continued presence of God's gifts to you. I mean, you think about, like, if I learned how to use my mech armor suit really, really well, I knew where all the buttons were, I knew about the trick latches, I knew about how that missile didn't fire sometimes, or this thing usually had problems, or any of these kinds of things, and I learned how to use my mech armor really, really, really well. As soon as you take away the mech armor, all those skills are basically useless. So no matter how skilled you are, the skills are usually connected to things that have been given to you by God. And if God were to strip those away from you, the skills really wouldn't make much of a difference. I mean, they wouldn't even be usable. And certainly, God will affirm those who have been disciplined and skilled, whether with little or with much in terms of gifting. And he will say to them, well done, not because of their gifts that he gave them, but because they work with those gifts for the sake of God's kingdom. So maybe I would say to those, the gift is not yours to begin with, and best let God praise you for your skill and not your own lips, or you have your petty reward in full for all your efforts. All right, so that's what I got to say about that. I don't know if that helps. Got the next question here, which is on magic. Why should Christians read or watch stories with magic? Well, first, I don't necessarily think they should read or watch them. I think they're allowed to, and I also think it could be profitable. I've written about this at some length for the Renew the Arts blog in the article Harry Potter, Natural Law or Supernatural Sorcery. So you can read that in full at the link in the show notes. I'll probably quote from it a little bit here in a bit. But the first thing you have to do is determine if the magic under discussion is actually magic in biblical terms, like witchcraft or sorcery, like truly, or whether it's just magic in symbolic or fictional or fantasy terms. I know this can be confusing because sometimes, like with Harry Potter, you'll have the same words being used, like witchcraft or witch or sorcerer. And quite evidently, the witches and sorcerers of Harry Potter are not communing with demons or making deals with the devil or using blood magic or whatever kind of stuff like that. In fact, the magic of Harry Potter is just a part of that fictional world's natural forces. And sometimes it's used unnaturally, perhaps, if you think about, you know, the murderous horcruxes that Voldemort creates or whatever. But even still, it's part of the fabric of that reality. And there are ways of using that reality in an immoral way within that framework. But again, the framework is not you're communing with demons or drawing in some evil power or something like that. It's just part of the way you manipulate that particular world's natural forces. So I write about this in my article, so I'll quote that here. In the Harry Potter world, magic is not supernatural. It is not in reference to some spirit or demon. Rather, magic is a natural phenomenon. There is not any mention at any point that the power of magic comes from any other source but the natural fabric of the Harry Potter world. Sorcerers in the Harry Potter world have natural capacities for manipulating the natural forces of magic that are seamlessly existent like any other natural force in their world. Witchcraft in Harry Potter operates almost exactly like science, and the sorcerers in Harry Potter learn to discipline their natural capacities for this science. It may be unfortunate that Rowling chose to call this magic sorcery or witchcraft, but Tolkien had wizardry and sorcery in The Lord of the Rings, and Christians rarely even mention it. It's just a different world. Consider that a farmer from 500 years ago, were he to be dropped into the middle of our contemporary industrialized society, would really have no framework to understand our science. His best explanation for most of it, and if we're honest, we feel this way sometimes too, is that it is magic. Self-propelled machines, the internet, Wi-Fi, microwaves, airplanes, electricity in every home, touch screens broadcasting images from across the world. We live in a time when technology has vastly outstripped our ability to comprehend its function. But the Bible does not condemn the manipulation of natural forces per se, since the dominion of the natural world is our natural domain. For me, Harry Potter is a world where magic has no reference to the supernatural. I accept it within Rowling's framework as a natural force of her imaginary universe. Sorcery is, in that world, operating exactly as science does in ours. There are evil scientists and good ones, but the natural forces are not to blame either way. C.S. Lewis, in his book The Abolition of Man, said, "There is something which unites magic and applied science, technology, while separating both from the wisdom of earlier ages. For the wise men of old, the cardinal problem had been how to conform the soul to reality, and the solution had been knowledge, self-discipline, and virtue. For magic and applied science alike, the problem is how to subdue reality to the wishes of men. The solution is a technique." End quote for C.S. Lewis. Continue my quote. "In Harry Potter's world, we see that the point of magic, similar to the point of technology in our world, is mostly to better the lot of the sorcerer or scientist. Magic science washes dishes for us, fixes, replaces glasses, it unlocks doors at the press of a wand or dongle. It makes transportation easier, more convenient, it entertains us, it does our heavy lifting. In Potter's world, it is this fact which makes Harry different. When he wants to bury his friend, he does it without magic. When he has a chance to become the most successful or the most powerful sorcerer, he doesn't take it. He is a good scientist, as much as he is a good sorcerer." End quote on that one. But there are narratives where magic is being portrayed that is far closer to the biblical idea of witchcraft. I'm thinking about the recent Disney show Agatha All Along, which skirts this ambiguity of reality and stereotype and other kinds of things, and has to directly address, actually, the issue of selfish power and its abuse, even in Agatha. And I don't think it arrives at a great solution to the problems that it creates. And further, I think its pretense that magic can be distinguished between good and bad magic is just naive. Even within its own narrative, it's naive. So I don't think the showrunners are attempting to get people curious about actual witchcraft, but that may be the outcome for some viewers. And honestly, I feel a whole lot more uncomfortable about that than I do about Harry Potter. I think a better story addressing real witchcraft, if you're interested, and the cost of its power would probably be Robert Eggers' The Witch. I don't necessarily recommend this movie now, but I think it is very thought-provoking and potentially very edifying. It was actually really edifying for me, but it's also extremely disturbing and not at all for the faint of heart. My wife left in the first 5 minutes. She was like, "Nope, nope, nopeity, nope," and she left. And God bless her. I think she probably made the right decision for herself. For instance, it's one of the only films, The Witch, I know of that has been endorsed by both the Church of Satan and the Roman Catholic Church as an authentic depiction of the satanic. So, you know, it's definitely intense. But it is by no means endorsing, I don't think, or flirting with witchcraft as a good thing. It clearly indicates that witchcraft is a grasp at evil power, and that those poor deceived souls, even if they're desperate, who turn to it, do so to their peril and the expense of everything. At least that's how I'm reading it. Others, perhaps deceived themselves a bit, might read it differently, but that's how I'm reading it. I would reiterate that you should proceed with great caution in your curiosity concerning actual witchcraft and demons. That is dangerous territory, so just be careful with that. But magic as a feature of a particular fictional or fantasy world seems to have almost nothing to do with magic in a biblical sense. And its uses within that fictional world would have to be assessed on their own terms and merits, I think. And I just really don't feel like just because a word witch or sorcery or whatever is used, especially at this point with the conventions of fantasy literature, really don't think we're talking about exactly the same thing. And anyway, so take that for what you will. I'll link to my Harry Potter article review or whatnot here in the show notes, and you can read that if you feel like it. Ho, ho, hello again. It's me again. Please go and rate and review and follow and all that stuff, this podcast, wherever you listen to it. It means a lot to us. And that is the end of this break. So Merry Christmas. So next question. I'm asked, what fictional books have you been reading lately? What value do you personally find in fiction? Okay. I love fiction. I read a lot of nonfiction as well, but recently I've been on a bit of an Arthurian legend kick. So I read Steinbeck's unfinished translation of Malory's Le Morte d'Arthur, which he calls The Acts of King Arthur and His Noble Knights. I loved it. I'm really bummed, actually, that Steinbeck didn't finish it. I really like Steinbeck. I recently read his Grapes of Wrath as well. And again, I think he's a fantastic novelist, and I get a lot out of his work. In that same vein of the Arthurian kick, I read Tolkien's excellent translation of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. Really, really good. Loved that. Listened to that one. It was wonderful. I also recently got into Wendell Berry. And I know I'm late to this train, and people have been telling me to read Wendell Berry for quite some time, but I read Jaber Crow, Nathan Coulter, and Hannah Coulter, and I do recommend them. They have an earthy and wholesome quality. His writing does. It's not sentimental or nostalgic as such, but it really does have this fortifying and instructive bittersweetness that I think was very helpful and edifying. Jaber Crow was my favorite of those three. Got to be honest, by the end of Hannah Coulter, I needed a little bit of a break from Wendell Berry. He's very wise, and he has a lot of profound things that he says in the mouths of his characters, but he does have a certain kind of monologic rather than dialogic quality to those characters, if you know what I'm talking about. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, maybe you can ask a question about the question episode. Anyway, I'm messing around. Okay. As for fiction in general, I could talk a while about this, but I'm just going to try and put it in a nutshell. I believe, like Novalis apparently said, that art makes the strange familiar and the familiar strange. And I think fiction has that capacity to engage the imagination so that we can learn, almost as if by experience, things that we have never and may never experience. So it makes these strange or alien concepts or experiences or even people more accessible and more understandable. I love that about fiction. And then on the other hand, I also believe it has the power to re-enchant things that have lost their force or their mystery because of the dullness of our overexposure. Familiarity breeds contempt, and familiarity also breeds that dullness of lack of recognition. And fiction has a beautiful way of piercing through that veil of our prejudices and preconceptions and the things we thought we knew to help us perceive the real truth and envision the good life and find inspiration and courage to do the right but often difficult thing. So I think fiction is essential to the development of a person's character and the understanding of virtue and empathy and sympathy for other people and understanding of the world and of the truth. So I'm a big fan of fiction, so get on the fiction train and read some good fiction. I mean, there's so many good books that have been written over the course of human history that you can get access to basically for free. I mean, it's wonderful. It's absolutely, I mean, here we are spending money every month so we can fill our minds with drivel that's just being produced in order to create additional content. It's just content, 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 and almost all of it is garbage. And there are thousands of years of great works just waiting for you to dig in. So get into that. And okay. Oh, on that topic, the next question, what art would you recommend for this season? I'm just going to assume that they mean the Christmas season because that's what I want that question to mean. So I love Christmas movies. I love them. Some of my favorites that I revisit every Christmas with my family include Charlie Brown Christmas, How the Grinch Stole Christmas, the old one and the Jim Carrey version. I think we like both of them quite a bit. I mean, Jim Carrey, that makeup on How the Grinch Stole Christmas, apparently it took hours and hours and hours, and it was so torturous for him to wear that they actually brought in a POW training official who was like an officer that trained POWs how to suffer interrogation and torture. And he came in and gave Jim Carrey some tips because that's how torturous it was to wear that makeup for that whole thing. And when you look at his performance, given the fact that he's basically being tortured by his, you know, prosthetics that whole entire time, it's a really great performance and it's kind of perfect. So anyway, I really like that one too. And Elf, another classic. Will Ferrell's performance in that is perfect. It's a Wonderful Life, one of the probably greatest and simplest told, but greatest movies, kind of a paradigm of movie making. Miracle on 34th Street, a little sentimental, but I think it's sweet and I like it. And all the Christmas carols, just like basically all of them. Red versions, stage versions, movie versions from George C. Scott to Jim Carrey, but especially the Muppet one with Micah Caine. And I also like listening for music to Sufjan Stevens' overstuffed multi-volume Christmas albums. Renew the Arts actually has an article on the second of those multi-volume collections called Silver and Gold. That's worth revisiting that article. I think Justice wrote that. He really liked that. He had to convince me over a long number of years to give Silver and Gold, or really any of the Christmas albums, and maybe even Sufjan Stevens himself, a chance. So shout out to Justice. I have come around to your side. I even actually like the horrible songs on Silver and Gold because I kind of understand, and he'll talk about it in the article, so you got to go check it out. But there's one on there where it's like, Jesus is the king, a-ling-a-ling-a-ring-a-ling-a-ding-a-dong. And it's you might say, oh, well, that's a little bit irreverent, etc. I don't actually think it's actually irreverent. I think the real thing there is he's making the point that we'll actually make later on in this very podcast in answer to a different question, so I'm not going to steal my thunder, but we'll get to that. Other music that I really like, I love singing Christmas hymns. We sometimes overlook the lyrics, I feel like. I mean, I do too sometimes, but every once in a while, they just hit me yet again, because they are some of the best lyrics in the whole hymn book. And last night, my extended family and I, we sang a bunch of Christmas hymns. I got my guitar out. Everybody sang around the table. There were like 20 or so people just belting Joy to the World. And I'm holding back tears. And I'm just hearing and believing my favorite stanza. No more let sins and sorrows grow, nor thorns infest the ground. He comes to make his blessings flow far as the curse is found. That is amazing. That is such a great line. Pure Isaac Watts right there. Love that guy. All right, my favorite Christmas poem is still Dunstan Thompson. It's called Fragment for Christmas. I'm just going to go ahead and read it. It's very short. But, dear Lord, and only ever faithful friend, for love of us rejected, tortured, torn, and we were there, who on the third day rose again and still looks after us descend, and to each wrecked, unstable house be born, in us, a child among your former foes. Whole lot packed into that one. Okay, so last question. By the way, if you haven't checked out Dunstan Thompson's work, you really should. Fascinating story of his life. And there was a recent collection of his poems called Here at Last is Love that Slant Books put out, edited by Gregory Wolfe, who used to be the editor for Image Journal two editors ago or something. Anyway, that's really, really good. Solid collection of poems if you want to check out some poems. Speaking of recommendations, make a good gift. All right. Last question. I've been wanting to buy an outdoor nativity set to decorate my house, but they all seem dishonoring to Jesus, cheap and plastic. In the way that Andre Serrano seemed to be pointing out that cheap plastic crucifixes sold at gas stations are like pissing on Jesus. I have an easier time buying cheap plastic reindeer than a cheap plastic nativity, but now I don't have a nativity to represent my faith to my neighbors. But would it actually be representative of my faith to put a cheap plastic nativity in front of my house? Or is it almost worse? All right. Well, first off, if you're not familiar with what he's talking about, familiar with Andre Serrano's work, Immersion, Piss Christ, Allison and I discussed that in episode 10 of season 3, which was itself a mailbag episode. Season 3 was on art history, and we started talking about it on episode 10, season 3, and I'll link to it, but we started talking about Andre Serrano's piece in around 7 minutes and 15 seconds in. Talked about it for about 5 to 7 minutes. So you should go and check that out. We talk a little bit about its significance, what we feel about it, what we think about it, why it generates discussion. So just get that out of the way. But secondly, I feel about this probably about the same as I feel about ichthuses, you know, the Jesus fish that people have on the back of cars. If you have a Jesus fish on the back of your car, will you please, for the love of God, please drive really competently and courteously and never act rudely at all? But I also just want to say, I don't think the ichthus does really much of anything, since most people are more likely to get a negative impression from a distance anyway than a positive one. And I don't really think anybody's going to be converted by a bumper sticker or an ichthus, like it's the interstate to Damascus or something. I don't think anybody's having an interstate to Damascus moment because of your bumper sticker or ichthus. I'm pretty sure. Like, maybe so. I mean, God can use anything, and I get it. He used the jawbone of a donkey. He can use the ichthus. I get it. But, and obviously, do what you will. I'm not trying to coerce or pressure you. I'm just saying maybe think about whether or not it actually does do any good. All right? It probably doesn't. That's just my opinion. And it sometimes does a lot of harm, especially if you just accidentally make a mistake and then people are like, ah, those Christians, always cutting people off and you didn't even mean to. Anyway, the nativity scene maybe is a little better. Hey, at least this it has this going for it, because the people who see it will have a greater chance of actually getting to know you as a neighbor. So it could maybe, without being too imposing, signal that those really sweet, helpful, kind, and well-groomed neighbors down the street are Christians, and so that's cool. But if you plan on being an isolated bad neighbor or a Karen for like the little dictators at the HOA, or to just generally be unpleasant or whatever, just don't put any nativity scene up or the ichthus on your car, and please don't tell anyone you're a Christian. Please, again, for the love of God, please. As far as the issue of most nativity scenes being cheap and plastic, this is actually really interesting to me. You could try to invest in something a little nicer if it's really important to you. Although you're going to have a hard time finding something that isn't basically white European Christmas family anyway. And maybe that's not the greatest thing. I don't know. Maybe we could talk about that sometime too. But even if it isn't all that nice, I actually think there's something appropriate about that for Christmas particularly. I'm thinking like the little Christmas tree in the Charlie Brown Christmas special, just pathetic on its own terms. And even before they famously didn't even manage to animate it very well between frames and such, Lee Mendelson talks about that. He was like, there's so many mistakes. And one of them was with that tiny little pathetic Christmas tree. And Lee Mendelson, who talked about the Charlie Brown Christmas special, said that they were rushed through the project and they had like half the budget and there were a lot of corners cut. But he felt like that in itself was one of the reasons that worked with the spirit of the special, that was similar to the spirit of that little tiny Christmas tree, which was cheap and poor. And there's something peculiarly appropriate to Christmas, that the little, that overlooked, even the seemingly cheap and poor and foolish things, should be the instruments of God's great work on earth, to humble the proud and shame the mighty and confound the wise. I'm reminded of Annie Dillard's really good piece called Bethlehem, which she wrote about her own more recent visit. I mean, I don't know how recent, but you know, like in modern times, visit to the purported site of Jesus's birth in Bethlehem. And she concludes that essay And the whole thing's worth reading. It's very interesting, but I just want to read the conclusion. So sorry if this is ruining. It's not really, but it's kind of the punchline. But whatever. If you don't want to hear it, then just shut this off and go and read Bethlehem by Annie Dillard, and you'll get here. But here's what she says. Any patch of ground anywhere smacks more of God's presence on earth to me than did this marble grotto in Bethlehem. The ugliness of the blunt and bumpy silver star impressed me. The pathetic pomp of the heavy tasseled brocades, the marble, the censers hanging from chains, the embroidered antependium, the aspergillum, the croziers, the ornate lamps, some human's idea of elegance, bespoke grand comedy, too, that God put up with it. And why should he not? Things here on earth get a whole lot worse than bad taste. Every day, said Rabbi Nachman of Bratslav, the glory is ready to emerge from its debasement. Anyway, so, end quote there. It's a great essay, by the way. You should check it out. So perhaps if you do put up the cheapest, campy, kitsch nativity you can find, I mean, just the biggest piece of garbage, tiny little silver and gold ring-a-ling-a-ding-a-long-a-ding-a-dong, tiny Charlie Christmas tree, terrible nativity scene that you can find, just make sure to put a banner over it that reads, "Every day the glory is ready to emerge from its debasement." And I'm pretty sure that'll at least start some conversations on the Nextdoor app. Anyway, Merry Christmas, everybody. Thank you all for listening. We're going to take a break for a couple months while we prepare material for next year. But I really appreciate your faithful support and engagement. And really, honestly, Merry, Merry, Merry Christmas. I'm so thankful for all of you. And for our final song of the season, I'd like to share the album version. This is what we usually do with these mailbag episodes. I'd like to share the album version of Civilized Creatures, Humble and Lowly, off his excellent record, Earthen Vessel, released in 2023. And that's the song that you've been hearing in instrumental version for this last 10 episodes. And Ryan Lane, the guy who is behind Civilized Creatures, he's the founder and the dude. I mean, it's basically a one-man band. And he's a great producer, photographer, family man, sourdough baker. And he's been a generous collaborator with us for many years. And he's provided instrumental versions for all our podcast seasons free of charge. And has always, I mean, he just tells us, you don't even have to ask. You can use whatever you want. And if I go and ask him, hey, can you make me an instrumental version of this? He'll apologize for not being able to send it right over because he's on a shoot or something. And he'll be like, when I get home, I'll do it. And he does always. He just follows through. Solid dude. Really like that guy. He's extremely cool. And I love this music. So I really do hope you'll check out his work and be generous with him as he's been generous with you and with us. So from me and everyone else here at Renew the Arts, Merry Christmas and enjoy.
A thorn in your side, and I need you to show me what is inside. They want me around that I don't have to hide. Help me see truth. You see the beauty in us all, and even if I fall. In his story, draw me close, Holy Ghost, would you steer me? Humble and lowly, taking my steps slowly. I know you're near me, help me to see clearly. Would you show me my place in his story? Draw me close, Holy Ghost, would you steer me? Humble and lowly, taking my steps slowly. And I'm trying so hard, and I'm still breaking down, and I'm falling apart, and I need you. The ugly inside.
inside is all that I see. Yeah, I need truth. You see the beauty in us all, and even if I fall,
I know you're near. I know you're near me. Help me to see clearly. Would you show me my place in this story? Draw me close, Holy Ghost, would you steer me? Humble and lowly, taking my steps slowly. I know you're near me, help me to see clearly. Would you show me my place in this story? Draw me close, Holy Ghost, would you steer me? Humble and lowly, taking my steps slowly.
Tears and the pain, all that helped me in darkness, all that held me in shame, all the shackles and chains are done away in your name.
I know you're near me, help me to see clearly. Would you show me my place in this story? Draw me close, Holy Ghost, would you steer me? Humble and lowly, taking my steps slowly. I know you're near me, help me to see clearly. Would you show me my place in this story? Draw me close, Holy Ghost, would you steer me? Humble and lowly, taking my steps slowly.